she had smoked beer at the liquor store.
Yeah.
And she
okay, welcome to this February 2nd, 2016 meeting of the Water Reclamation Facility Citizens Advisory Committee.
I don't think there's a beer here.
My mic is on. My light is on.
Don't.
You said give them a
test.
Is it working now? No.
I think they can probably hear it.
This one.
There. Test.
I think they can probably hear it back on the panel back there, but it's just not coming out to the house.
Okay. Well, until that's resolved, I apologize. We have one of our largest audiences. My apologies to all you back there.
Sorry.
We could have them gather up to the closer.
Here.
Maybe this one.
That one reach probably.
Okay. Is that one feeding though to you? No.
Okay, this one is hot. So welcome to our February 2nd meeting of the Water Reclamation Facility Citizens Advisory Committee. We'll start by establishing a quorum and looking around. All members are present except Mr. Sadowski. And so we'll call this meeting to order. If we could all have a moment of silence, please. Thank you, and let's rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, do we have any announcements or presentations today to be given? Staff, is there anything on your end?
I have an update on our usually scheduled joint meeting with the Cayuga Sanitary District that would typically be held the second Thursday of the month. Due to a conflict with the Coastal Commission reception, we're attempting to reschedule that meeting. So you'll see a cancellation notice going up for next Thursday, and then we're polling the two bodies to see when they can meet. Thank you.
Okay. Any announcements from any members up here? All right. That moves us to public comment. Oh, I'm sorry. You did have an announcement,
yeah,
Jenny.
I'm sorry. We did. Just as a follow-up to what Rob presented, what was brought to my attention from a citizen was that the Cayuga Sanitary District offers or is having town hall meetings on their project, their progress, questions and answers, excuse me, and was told they were quite informative and interesting. So the next one is scheduled for Thursday, February 18th at the Vets Hall at 6 p.m. Maybe a couple of us might want to go up just to kind of see what's going on there. Go ahead.
I actually went to the last one and it was very informative and very well done.
Okay, thanks. Give us some ideas for our community outreach. So again, that's February 18th, 6 p.m., Cayucas Vets Hall. Thank you, John.
Also the OPC, that's the Ocean Protection Council, not the other one, is having a meeting tomorrow, and they're going to be discussing Prop 1 funding. So some of us are going to that in Sacramento.
A quick announcement. I wanted to give a shout out to Bruce Keough, who gave me a terrific tour of the Morro Bay Wastewater Treatment Plant. And I know some of my colleagues here have already had a tour, but I would recommend anybody that hasn't had a tour, including the public, take it. It's very, very informative, and you're a great guide. Thank you so much.
All right. So we'll move on to public comment, and this is for members of the public to speak on anything that's not on the agenda. Do we have any interested parties to speak on public comment? Okay. Now we have the consent calendar, and this is approval of the minutes from both our November 17th, 2015 meeting and our January 5th, 2016 meeting. If there aren't any comments or edits, I'd entertain a motion of approval of the consent calendar.
I just have one on the minutes to January 5th. In the comments, just a addition regarding, let's see here, my comment with regards to industrial waste.
That's under C?
That's under C, correct. And I stated that the city should not be subsidizing not only California state parks, but also industrial waste dischargers that are into the collection system. You can verify it on YouTube. Thanks.
Any other comments or corrections?
I make a motion to approve both minutes of the meetings with the amendments made by Richard Sadowski.
I second.
I'll second that.
Okay, well, we have a motion by Member Shively and a second by Member Woodson. Then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Item B. Business items. B1 is an update on the water reclamation facility. I'll turn this over to staff for a presentation.
Thank you. I'll give a quick summary and some updates to some items in the staff report. We continued coordination with DWR and State Water Resources Control Board for the recycled water facilities planning grant application. I do have an update on that. So we did receive word that the part of it that DWR reviews to confirm that the city's meeting its commitment to water conservation, they have finished their review and approved their part of it. So now it's back to state board. So by end of February, early March, we're anticipating that we'll receive word on whether the application's been accepted or not, whether it's been approved or not. So we should have an update shortly. We continued the fatal flaw analysis and negotiation with the owners of the Moro Valley properties, and John's going to give an update on some of the fatal flaw work that had been conducted over the last couple of months that you all are all aware of. We reviewed the draft report on Moro Valley groundwater that Paul Sorensen with Fugro is going to be presenting, so that'll be another item today. Completed the WRF program website. We're continuing to update that and add information, but I would suggest you get on there and provide any input and suggestions you've got. We put the URL here. It's morobaywrf.com, and there are spots on there where both industry and just concerned interested members of the public can register for updates, and so they become part of an email list and contact list where we can reach out to them for future meetings and that sort of thing.
I just want to add that you can also access that site through the traditional way of going through the city's website, and it'll redirect there. Thank you.
Yep. And then we began an internal draft of the notice of preparation for CEQA compliance. So we've been working with ESA on that. In terms of budget and expenses, so we've been working with the financial subcommittee. I know they're going to give an update later, so I won't jump into too much detail there. But we are working with them on a revised summary report to provide WRF, CAC, and council. I'm glad to answer any questions you've got on this. We have this is called a commitments log in our Procore project management software. What it basically is similar to the report that we've provided in past months to the committee. It gives the status of the various contracts. At this point, these are all planning contracts and studies, but it gives the status, whether change orders have been approved. You'll see a column for a term called draw requests. Draw requests are invoices that have been submitted for review by us in the city but may or may not have been approved, and then it gives the total amount that's been paid. So it gives a good snapshot on those consultant contracts. And also have attached some additional information on the state water project. So the chairman provided a nice graphic that kind of gives an overview of the coastal branch of the State Water Project. We had some discussion on that at the last advisory committee meeting, and so provided this just to answer some questions about, you know, what the extents roughly are of the Coastal Water Project. And then another item I did want to update you all on too. One of the questions from the last meeting was, could we estimate roughly how many self-regenerating water softeners there might be in Morro Bay? So we did, as we took a look at the pounds of chlorides that were generated at nighttime based on the sampling that we discussed in detail at the last meeting. Our estimate is probably in the neighborhood of 500 to 1,000, plus or minus. There might be that many. It's difficult to get an exact number, but we feel like it's in that range. And I think roughly, Rob, what we were talking about is that might be 10-20%, something like that, of homes in Morro Bay could. So, and that's a rough percent. Could be higher, could be lower, but just in the ball, that's the ballpark we'd expect.
Mike, last time we learned that Culligan was discharging a lot of their stuff right in the sewer. Are they just discharging Morro Bay customers or customers from around the region? Or what are we getting? Do we know?
It's their customer base, so it's not necessarily limited to the city.
It's not limited to Morro Bay?
No.
Okay. Okay, is there any public comment on this item? Okay, seeing none, any other questions for staff from the advisory committee? And this is just to receive an update, so we'll do exactly that and move on to item B2, which is subcommittee updates. And I think I do have a couple. I'll start with my right here with the finance subcommittee.
Thanks, John. Yes, as a follow-up to what Mr. Nunley said, we did look at the commitments log, and the Finance Subcommittee met about 10 days ago to briefly discuss that commitments log and what we might do in terms of defining our requirements for what we feel would be more comprehensive budget and accounting information to help manage a project of this magnitude. So, and we feel eventually that this is the kind of information that the citizens would need, maybe summarized even at a higher level. So the template I provided, some of you have two copies, it's the same thing. I tried to print it on a legal size paper and it really didn't make it any more legible. My goal was to keep it on one sheet, and I don't expect you to even be able to read any of that. I just want to go over it at a very high level. I'm serving on the Citizens Finance Committee for Morro Bay, and we're working. One of our members is very knowledgeable in public accounting and developed this template, and we have revised it for the Citizens Finance Committee for city budgeting, perhaps, but I tweaked it further for the WRF. So this is kind of where this is coming from. But basically, at a very high level, I put two things here. Number one, the top half or two-thirds of your sheet is the expenditures, basically all the expenditures. And I went and I think I used an old one, Mike, from maybe October 28th or something, and pulled some of those numbers for budgets out. So kind of ignore the numbers. It's just what I had to show you at the time. So the top half is expenditures. The bottom half is revenue. And then they're divided into thirds: quarterly reporting, year-to-date reporting, and then finally fiscal year reporting. And all we're showing there is the budget, expenditures against it, percent expended, any variance. And in the final column, fiscal year, we also have added a column which says encumbrances, meaning if there's any, especially with all these contracts, single large expenditures that have not been paid yet but have been committed to being paid, that's what would go in your typical encumbrances. So what I don't have here, and I think we may, again, this is just a starting point. Typically, in large projects, in my business, in the IT business, we also see percent completed, and I'm sure that would be the case in construction. So you may want to add a column that says percent completed of a particular contract. You could add columns in that would say red flag, things that are maybe at the end of quarter one more than 25% exceeded or under by some gross amount, you know, $25,000 or whatever number you choose. And then they're color-coded just for budget versus expenditures just to make it easier. You know, that's just all prettying it up. So I believe this is much more comprehensive than, Mike, the commitments log, but we could put in labor, operating expenses you see I have there, plus some of the contracts, the names by names. Or after you get it at this detailed level, you might just summarize it all and put it on the website, the WRF, basically saying, hey, nobody needs to know all the individual contract amounts, but maybe they need to know the total amount. There's a lot you could do with it. This was just an attempt to get something on paper, and I believe to properly manage something of this scope, it's going to take more than what the Procore software has, at least from what I've seen. And typically I see a lot of these things where you might be tracking other, like business licenses on a different system, you might be tracking your budgeting on something else, SAP, and then you have to integrate them together. So I'll stop there and entertain any questions or comments.
Any question or comments from the committee?
I have one for you, Barbara.
Thank you.
That just came up since we've talked. Is there any advantage, and maybe this is more directed to staff, is there any advantage to have a column on how, you know, you have a build team, like Mr. Buckingham likes to call it, and you have your staff, and then you have your hired consultants. Is there any advantage to have a column that says how much staff time is being put in?
So looking at this report, we do have down near the bottom of the top two-thirds an area for staff time. And since our payroll software... we have set up a project code that we enter our time into. That should be relatively simple to recover out of there. Not sure how easy benefits will come out of the system because they're not all paid from the same fund. So that might be a little bit more, because we don't charge benefits to the project, all of them. Some of them are masked in the department, and my voice just got quieter for some strange reason.
And that's exactly why we included that in there. Sometimes I see on these reports they'll just put a percentage in for benefits, you know, 20-30%, whatever it is, maybe accrue it out at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Or you may say if those are indirectly affecting the project cost of building this WRF, then yes, they should be here somehow, some way. If not, you might just take them out and, you know, track your labor and anything else. And then I just made up some operational supplies.
Yeah, we'll work with Susan and Chris on getting the export out of there. One comment on your, I don't think Susan or Chris would let us charge meetings or conferences to a project, so there probably won't be any in that row. So we may have some other expenses that we want to add to it, but meetings or conferences wouldn't be one of them.
I wasn't real sure because of all the travel. That's what I was kind of getting at involved with this, like to go back to D.C. or whatever. But however, you know, this is our tool for reporting and managing it, so it needs to work for us.
Okay.
Thank you for explaining.
Oh, by our, I mean City Citizens Committee.
The Royal We.
The Royal We. Thank you.
And just so you know, so the follow-up to that is we're going to be meeting with Susan Slayton over the next week or so and try to determine, you know, we'll put together a version. Might be close to this, might be a few modifications. We'd like to bounce that back and forth with the subcommittee. So we'll be working with you on that.
Right. Also, I did. We skimmed this down. The colleague of mine that developed this, Greg Head, he has a lot of instructions and everything that go with it. I took it all out just for simplification, but most of it's self-explanatory. But we can make this as, you know, glamorous as you'd like.
Okay.
In the staff time, I know we're in transition here with Cayucas, but is that... Are they being charged or billed in some way with regards to this?
No, they're not being charged or billed. Okay. If they enter the project again, they'll get a lump sum bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have a comment and a question. Actually, this is about process. We're just talking about updates right now from the Finance Committee. We're not talking about the budget itself, the report, because I have some questions on the report.
That was the previous item.
Okay, sorry, I missed that. Can I ask a question about that or not?
Sure.
Okay, just a quick question on the budget. It appears that there's no budget for the fatal flaws analysis for geotechnical and initial hydrogeologic field testing for the Rigetti property, and I'm wondering whether... Or does the $86,400 budgeted for the activities on the McIlvain property address this?
So the...
I didn't see a line item for Rigetti for
yeah,
that.
Understood. And so the Rigetti information, when a few years ago when Dudek developed the analysis to look at different sites, Earth Systems as a subconsultant to them actually collected borings on the Rigetti property. So the nice thing was we didn't have to go get additional field information or do any additional work. The level of analysis they went through at the Rigetti site then was comparable to what we had done at Rancho Colina. And the Fugro contract there, it includes the McIlvain property fatal flaws, but it also includes this initial hydrologic field, the initial hydrologic work like we'll talk about today. So it was there was additional work besides just the McIlvain feasibility study there.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
And then, let's see, 30% of the funding for grant and SRF support has been spent, about $20,000. So that basically is just to develop the application that you mentioned earlier. Or was it used to locate additional grants? What does that $20,000 represent?
So it's been used for two applications so far. So first was the planning grant application, and then also for the SRF loan application, and then also for the updates that Kestrel had. This is the updates that Kestrel had provided. I believe about 6 months ago, they provided an update for WRFCAC. And then they've been tracking and the programs as they've been coming up. So that's included in there.
Okay, so that also includes additional research for funding sources?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then I guess, I'm sorry, back to the agenda then. I had a couple of comments for the update. First of all, I wanted to thank Barbara for this excellent graphic. And the thing is it's just an example to show efficiency where she's been on another committee and shared that information, and I hope we can see more of that. In terms of updates, I just wanted to give a quick update on EPA's Water Infrastructure and Resilience Finance Center. I've mentioned this several times. One thing I thought that was interesting, they keep adding information to that website, which is www.epa.gov/waterfinancecenter. One of the things that I found was interesting is that they've developed regional environmental finance centers now to help communities across the country to develop sustainable how-to-pay solutions to meet environmental goals. And so I was looking to see what that entailed. And basically what it is they have... they put together regional water finance forums, and the last one was in Texas. And basically, everybody's invited to tune into this. And communities, you can hear how communities have made financing decisions with sustainable operations in mind, network with peers on implementing successful financing strategies, and interact with experts to discuss local infrastructure financing needs. So the next one that I saw is coming up in Portland, Oregon. It's on March 31st. So I really recommend that Kestrel and you maybe take a look at that site, because it really has some amazing information. It's a great clearinghouse. And then I just wanted to mention a couple of press releases that caught my eye. One was EPA Region 9 announced more than $182 million in additional funding to California for investment in statewide for water quality projects to reduce water pollution, improve municipal drinking water and wastewater infrastructure, and to make projects more sustainable by increasing water and energy efficiency. And basically, it highlighted a $30 million funding through 1% interest SRF loan, and it's been used by Carlsbad Water Recycling Facility. I don't know if you're familiar with that facility, but basically it nearly doubled its capacity to generate water for non-potable uses like irrigation and industrial uses. So that's something to look at if you haven't already. And that funding is basically, it's going to be expanding their current water recycling facility from 4,100 acre feet per year to 7,235 acre feet per year. That $30 million with the 1% interest is going to be used to construct 18 miles of pipe, as well as a new storage tank, and install 156 new recycled water meters. And once it's completed, Carlsbad will recycle and use all of its wastewater during the summer months, meeting nearly 33% of its water district's annual water needs. And then very quickly, another press release I saw showed that EPA's recent survey indicates that $271 billion is needed for the nation's wastewater infrastructure, and that's just within the next 5 years. And that $271 billion, by the way, includes $6.1 billion for recycled water distribution. So those are my items for today.
Okay, any comments on that or on the budget? Suggestions on the budget?
I just want to thank Barbara for this, and I concur with her suggestion that we have a percent complete column added. I'm a little bit uncertain as to the difference between year to date and fiscal year. It seems to me that they would probably be the same year. I don't know why they're distinct. And I guess my last comment would be something along the lines of, there's a lot of contracts that'll be longer than a year, and so you're going to need to have a roll-up column for multi-year contracts. I don't see where you would do that in here. Maybe I'm just missing it.
No, I'll address that. Thanks, Bill. Good comments. You're not missing it. There were no more columns I could put on my one sheet of paper without everybody going crazy or ignoring it. But the Morro Bay, the city fiscal year ends June 30th, so year to date could be like the second quarter, cum, it's a cum, and fiscal year might be just the total budget and the amended budget. That would only be the same at the end of the fourth quarter. But you're absolutely right, and some people might even tell you, hey, we want this monthly reporting instead of quarterly. Add more columns, or what I would add on the right definitely would be the total project history, which would be a cum of all the costs to date. So, again, absolutely correct. And I agree, the percent completion is very important.
Great, thank you.
One suggestion on kind of life to date on the project. I think we could eliminate maybe fiscal year or combine fiscal year and year to date and add a life to date section that would cover that ability.
I like it. Good.
Great, I agree as well. A full life cycle cost of the multi-year contracts is maybe some of the most important information on this sheet. Okay, moving on to engineering. I believe you have a report also.
Yes, first one on the committee. Committee members Dale Guerra, Paul Donnelly, and myself met with John Rickenbach and Mike Nunley yesterday to discuss the report that's included in your packet today. Mm-hmm. We will be discussing it as part of item B4, and I don't want to give away any surprise ending since, but we did go through, and it appears that groundwater percolation is going to be a real challenge out in the Moro Valley area and on the Rancho Colina site in particular, and pretty much elsewhere throughout that area, although we did come up looking at a couple of alternatives of how to try and utilize that, but I'm not going to go into it right now. We'll be discussing it as we get into it, but just to let you know, we did meet with them, go over the report, and I thought it was a very good report that was done, but we may have to look at other ways for disposing of the water, just not in the groundwater recharge environment, and that's one of the things this report did tell us. Did you have anything else?
No.
Okay, thank you. Engineer or environmental, any update this meeting? No? Okay. Anyone from the public wish to comment on the subcommittee reports? Seeing none, this is also receive and consider update, so we'll close out this item, move on to B3, which is an update from staff on site evaluation and fatal flaw analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do today is bring you up to date on a few things. This is all couched in terms of the fatal flaw analysis, but what we're trying to lead up to is the meeting with the council coming up where we're really going to use that information to help evaluate, again, the comparative merits of Rancho Colina and the Rigetti property next door, because we're really looking at both of those sites and have been, and that's what the fatal flaws study has been looking at. So what I've got is actually a short presentation that's on the PowerPoint, and I don't know how well you'll be able to see it from your seat, so you may want to find a better way to look at this. Unfortunately, we can't reconfigure the room here. But what I'd like to do is sort of go over what we've known in the past, what the fatal flaw studies were intended to do, and where we're going to go with it next in terms of what we've learned. First of all, let's see if this works. Don't know that this works. Paul, you want to help? Okay. We've got it, but this thing, switch on the side here. Let's try that. Beautiful. Okay. So what we've done, what we're trying to do now is provide an update on what's happened on Rancho Colina and Rigetti since May 2014. At that time, the council provided direction, and I'm going to go through that a little bit, to really investigate the Rancho Colina property for the purposes of determining that as the preferred site at that time. A little difficult for you to read here, I think, but I'll tell you what this says. In December 2013, the council had looked at a report that considered many sites, narrowed it down to a handful. Ultimately, they told us, look at the three best, one of which was the Moro Valley in general, one of which was the Giannini site, and one of which was the Choro Valley, and there were sites in the Choro Valley as well. In May 2014, the council said Moro Valley is best and said that the Rancho Colina property was the best among the two in the sites within the Moro Valley. This map here depicts what we had looked at in May of 2014. The big blob on the top is the Moro Valley. The big one on the bottom is Choro Valley. It's a little wedge off the western side of Choro Valley, which is the Giannini property. And within each of those, there's dark blobs. And those are the areas we really focused on in our report at that time. At this scale, it's a little difficult to see. But in the northernmost of those two, Moro Valley, the oval on the left is Rigetti, the part of Rigetti we really focused on. And on the right, that's Rancho Colina. At the time, Rancho Colina was ranked highest for a lot of reasons, good reasons. Very receptive property owner. There's an old wastewater plant there that could be replaced if this were put in to replace it as a city facility. good proximity to reclamation opportunities if it were couched in terms of ag opportunities in the Moro Valley. It's a graded site where we were looking at. Could be used as any in this area as a regional facility if Cayucas were involved, consistent with coastal policies. It had a challenge in that it was a little farther up 41 than Rigetti, so cost might be a little higher. Rigetti was also good, not rated quite as high, had really good proximity to existing infrastructure, reclamation, could be a regional facility, again, consistent with coastal policies. This challenge is, the main challenge at the time is the city, the property owner had no interest in selling to the city. It wasn't available to the city. You also had a neighborhood relatively nearby. And it had slightly more potential challenges relative to drainages that might be jurisdictional waters. So for those reasons, Rancho Colina ranked highest, but both, actually all four of the sites, the two in Moro Valley and the other two, could have been suitable for a WRF. And at the end of the day, Rigetti was second, close second. You can't read all this, but this was our original summary in the report. What you want to take away from this at this distance, it's a little difficult to see the green versus the yellow, but wherever it's green, that's one criteria or another where it ranked very high. Rancho Colina on the left, Rigetti on the right. Yellow were moderately good, and when you shook it all out, Rancho Colina was rated high and Rigetti moderately high at that time. So since then, the council has directed us to do all kinds of studies on Rancho Colina and Moro Valley in general to see what makes the most sense, if that still makes the most sense. So we did several studies since then, fatal flaw related studies, to make sure we don't have a serious problem at either site to go forward. Biology, cultural resources, hydrogeology, geotech. The very short story out of all of that is there are no fatal flaws associated with any of those reports. There are challenges that each of those issues presents at each site. I'm not going to go into great detail here on the findings, on certainly not on the hydrogeology or geotech. Paul can handle that better than I could. But on biology, the short story there was you do have some jurisdictional drainages. That is to say, drainages that come off the hills and end up in Moro Creek on both sites. In the case of Rigetti, you have them going through sort of the flatter part of the site too. So you'd have to figure out a way to design and permit around those. In the case of cultural resources, they're both sensitive sites in a general sense. There's a lot of sensitivity in the area in general, and there are sites that we've known about associated with the Highway 41 right-of-way, especially as you get closer to the city. That would be a challenge for either site because you're going to deal with pipeline issues. On these two sites themselves, what we found in our recent investigations are, in general, the Rigetti site is moderately sensitive. That is to say, no artifacts were found within their, and they surveyed the site in detail. None were found, but the potential is there to find things that they didn't come across. In the case of Rancho Colina, part of the site is of low sensitivity and part is of high sensitivity. So you end up with sort of a wash. They're both relatively sensitive, as you might expect for anything in this part of the valley, given the past history here. But in neither case would you consider cultural resources to be a fatal flaw for either site. I won't speak to the hydrogeology or geotech, but again, there are challenges involved with both. The hydrogeology really is more an off-site issue to a large extent. What do you do with the water? The geotech is important in the sense that on the Rigetti site, you've got sort of flat, deep soils. You can work with that more easily. Where we're looking at on Rancho Colina, you've got some difficulties because you have some bedrock issues, and all of that ultimately affects cost and design to some extent. And I bring up Rancho Colina in a different way than I had in the past, because one of the reasons we looked at things again was to look at these sites in general. But there are certain issues that have changed relative to Rancho Colina, which I'll allude to in a moment. First, I want to just show you a couple of maps from our reports. And again, what I want to let you guys know is we are putting together a full report that I'm summarizing the highlights of. And we're not quite done with the report yet. But I want to give you the heads up that it's coming, and we expect to have that report ready for City Council, and I believe that you folks will be meeting with City Council next week. We haven't figured out the logistics of that quite yet, but that will be available to both you and them at the same time, and then we'll take it from there. So you're getting a short version of what you'll be hearing again. This map here, I just wanted to give you a feel for what these studies looked at in terms of area. This is a map from the biology report. The big rectangular blob in the middle is the extent to what we looked at on the biological resources assessment for Rancho Colina. And to give you a feel for what's there, you can see the mobile home park to the left, and you can see the house on the McIlvain property just to the north of that yellow rectangle within there. So we really looked at it fairly comprehensively. I think the whole, all told, they looked at 15 or 18 acres within that property. And here on the Rigetti site, we actually looked at a larger area, which spanned the distance from the mobile home park on the right all the way to the left to the existing city limits on the lower part of the site. Again, looking at areas where potentially you could put a facility. So that gives you an aerial extent. And it was something similar for that on the Cultural Resources report as well. We wanted to make sure we covered enough area to allow some flexibility. Now, there's been some other new information which is very important relative to the site reevaluation since 2014, and that has to do with issues having to do with property ownership. On the Rancho Colina site, our assumption at that time was to look at, and I think I've got this graphic here. I'll come back to that last slide in a moment. But this graphic is from our report from May 2014, and it shows what we looked at on the Rigetti and Rancho Colina sites. Neither is identified clearly at this distance, but the Rigetti site is the western third within that larger rectangle, and the specific area we really focused on was that little red oval on the left, the lower left, because that was the focus of where the best potential for a new facility could be. On Rancho Colina, which is in the central part of that large rectangle, which, by the way, is the Moro Valley site from the original report, we looked at the oval on the right, and that was the flattest, easiest, best area, lowest to locate a facility. But since 2014, the property owner, and thank you, Paul. Yeah, here we go. This is helpful. Right there is where we looked at before. This just, there's no way I can not shake a little bit. And then down here is Rigetti. So that's what we looked at before. But now we're looking at a piece just to the left of that, also on the McIlvain property. There's a reason for that. And I'll go back to that here. In consultation with the property owner and his family, we've determined, and they've determined really, that they would rather have the city not look at that best, lowest part of the site. For the same reason we'd want it, they would want to hold on to it. It is the best part relative to the ability to do anything on. So they'd like us to look at an 8-acre portion a bit to the west. It's a little higher ground. It's a little closer to the highway. It's a little closer to the mobile home park over there. And we hadn't studied that before. And so that wasn't really the focus of our previous investigation. They also would like us to limit what we do on that site to just wastewater and water-related facilities. So any other kind of city desires that relate to corporation yards or any other kind of goals a city may want to pursue, they would not want us to do that on their property. So, and we understand that. So those are the parameters that we're dealing with there. And, of course, we've been working very closely with Mr. McIlvain over the last few months on those questions, even as recently as yesterday, just to confirm that's still the case and that still is the case. So that's the new playing field for Rancho Colina that this updated investigation looks at. Rigetti, we're not changing anything that we had looked at from before. The difference is we're looking at things in a little bit more detail. But there is another difference. At the time we looked at things before, the property was really not in a position to be acquired by the city. Since that time, and certainly in recent months, it has become available, and the city has been pursuing that conceptually to the point now where the city has entered into an MOU on that site. In the event we want to go in that direction, the city does now have an option to purchase the property. So that's a big change from what we knew before. So, and of course, if we don't go there, we don't have to purchase the property, but we do have that available if that's the direction we go. So again, we go to the map, and that property really spans a large area. It's not just that little oval down there. It's the essentially the western third of that larger rectangle, about 260 acres in total. The best flatter parts of that are at the far southern end, but it's limited more into the 30-acre range or so. But again, plenty of room to do a lot of things. So here's the short story of the updated findings of the report you're going to be reading soon. Both sites are still suitable for a water reclamation facility. Rigetti now ranks higher relative to some of the issues we've just talked about. The key factors there, the city can control, purchase the site without any restrictions, either on location or what could be done. Likely lower project costs. That was always true before, too, because you wouldn't have to extend pipelines as far up the valley. The proximity to the deeper portion of the groundwater basin, and that relates to some of the work Paul Sorensen at Fugro has done relative to how the Moro Valley groundwater situation plays out. It's deeper, farther downstream, and that's close to where the Rigetti site is too. So if that's part of the solution on reclamation, that comes into play as well. It's less visually prominent. Before we had assumed on Rancho Colina that it'd be on the lower site and could be tucked back a little farther. Now we're limited closer to the highway and up a little higher. Visual comes into play on a couple of fronts. One, just from everyday drivers going by. And two, the Coastal Commission, who opined back at the end of 2013 in a letter, which will be in the report, that said either site could work, but visual issues are going to be an important consideration in permitting from Coastal. Well, this being the case, now that you've got more impacts, let's put it that way, relative to the other on Rancho Colina, that will come into play. Ultimately, the last bullet point's important too. There's more area and flexibility at Rigetti because the whole site would be available to pursue not only the WRF but other city goals as appropriate. So that gives you a flavor for what the report's going to say. And this last one is again an updated version of the old comparative side by side. Again, you know, there's pros and cons of each, and this covers all these different issues we've just talked about. But now Rigetti comes out a little bit higher. So the process has played out in a way that was always envisioned when the council asked us to look at things in more depth, and that's what we've done, and that's where we're at today. So any questions, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, any questions from the committee? We'll start here at the far left. Dale?
I got two. One is property cost. If it's going to save money for the pipeline, but you're going to be buying a lot more property, is that going to offset, or is it going to cost you more to go to Rigetti than it is to go to McIlvain? Another thing is, when this all first started at McIlvain, it was only supposed to be just a facility, and I think it was 6 acres, and there wasn't supposed to be a corporate yard, and then it changed as it progressed. So I don't, you know, as far as your slides go, as now the owner of the property is unwilling, it's not that. It's just that the city has changed their mind as far as I can see.
And let me address a couple of those. First of all, I wouldn't characterize Mr. McIlvain as unwilling. I think just the parameters have changed a little bit. I think he's still trying to be as cooperative with the city as always. I think that's a fair characterization. As far as what can be done, it is true that the council's goals have evolved over time, but even at the time of May 2014 when they went forward, the goals to do other things, whether that was corp yards or composting or any number of things, were on the table at that time. Where we had looked at on the McIlvain property before was really a 10 to 15 acre focus with some potential for expansion if it worked out. But it's very true that those were unknowns. What we do know now is there's less flexibility there, more at the other site. Relative to cost for acquisition of the property, we maybe Rob has something to say there, but it is true there would be a cost to acquire the Rigetti site. We don't know what the cost to acquire the Rancho Colina, the portion of Rancho Colina, would have been, but if we go that way, we'd still have to go down that road. But that would be a cost to either site. I don't know the relative cost, but it is very true that the cost for extending pipeline up the valley would be something that could be avoided at Rigetti, and that's not an insignificant cost. And Mike, you correct me, but it's something on the lines of $1 million per mile a pipe. The number of pipes, we're talking about four in that proximity. It's about $4 million, plus or minus. So
maybe a little less than that. Yeah. I think it's closer to a half a mile distance between where the pipe terminus is. So, you know, in rough numbers, we're talking $2 million in pipe costs to go that extra distance. Of course, the property, because it's a larger piece, and through negotiations with the Rigetti Trust, they don't have a desire to split off a piece of that property. They want to sell it in its entirety. So those would have higher costs. The appraisal has not been completed yet. We've sent out a request for proposal to three appraisers that are in that the Rigetti property owner and the city have agreed to. So we'll have those costs coming in relatively soon.
Along those lines, isn't there a lease that the city pays for the water tank?
Yes. At the top of the Rigetti property, the city pays $25,000 a year for about an acre of land that if the city were to acquire that property, we would no longer lease it to ourselves.
And possibly eliminate the Nutmeg access in the neighborhood?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Any comments or questions at this time?
When we visited the McElvey property a year or so ago, I don't know where I got this idea, but my thought was is that we were going to be building the new facility basically in the vicinity of where the existing is today. And that saved it from proximity issues to neighborhood. And I guess my concern is, how close are we getting to Rancho Colina by staying at that particular site? I did attend a public meeting, and many people came from the Rancho Colina residential area, and they certainly do have concerns. But at that time, I don't think they even knew where this facility is going to be located and how close are we getting to their homes.
It's a good question. Where it, you correctly characterized the location more or less what we had considered before. We're more or less replacing the old facility and working a little bit closer to the highway, not closer to the homes over there. That would have put you over a small rise in the neighborhood of something like 1,000 or more feet. It was a good distance. Now we'd be moving to the west, where the closest portion of the 8 acres that are available now could be as close as a couple of hundred feet from the trailer part, and then the nearest permanent homes are within the closest ones within, I'm guessing here, 400 feet, 500 feet, something like that, but in direct line of sight to some of them. So it would have been, it's definitely going to be much closer. There's no question about that with the new site.
I think regardless of the proximity, 1,000 feet versus 500, we would still need to do some sort of screening between the facility and the neighboring mobile home park property.
Valerie, any other comments?
No? Okay. Okay, I got a quick one. Because actually I kind of liked the Rigetti property when we first went through these gyrations a year and a half ago. And the main reason was the proximity with the city and the resulting less pipeline needed down Highway 41. But there's also another cost, and that's the operational cost. You got about 80 feet less head required for the pump station to have to run every day of the year for the next 40 plus years. So I think you might want to add that as one of the advantages in your report when you come back to the city council, because that's a pretty substantial number when you take it in the whole lifetime of this project. I do see the concern. And I'm assuming, because you say it's a big piece of property, and I remember one of the earlier reasons was the grading concerns on the Rigetti property because of that Blue Lines creek that runs across it. Now that we're going to the SBRs and MBRs, I kind of look at those as not being as grade sensitive as if you're putting in oxidation ditches and those kind of treatment facilities. Have you taken a look to see, are you assuming that this plant's going to be up near the highway as opposed to deep back in the property? Because if you're going back into the property, you're going to lose any advantage you gain on the head requirements and everything else.
Yeah, in general, the part that looks the flattest and easiest to build is probably where at least a lot of facilities will be concentrated. I think it's also fair to say that you'd have to do grading into those hills as it goes up the sides, whether that's just to locate things or to avoid certain resources. And there's a lot of things in the design we'd have to consider.
And I assume this property, Rigetti, is contiguous with the urban boundary of the city. Is that correct?
It is.
So from LAFCO's sense, it doesn't become an island sitting out there, you know, half mile away or better from the rest of the urban area. And as far as the additional land goes, my only other question is there any reason why it can't be split off after the fact and the city put it up for sale if they don't wish to take on that, you know, in the future, take on the liability? I don't know how the farmers are out there, whether they'd want to pick it up or not, because I think it's mainly grazing grounds, as I understand. But I could see the ability maybe to recoup a little bit of the land cost in a manner like that. And I guess I feel a little like a cheerleader towards the Rigetti side, but I kind of look at it from the cost aspect of things, and I always thought that was from purely a cost issue. And I'm glad to hear that they are looking to put it up for sale, because either place works. I think Rancho Colina works fine, except you have the additional costs that go into getting out to that location. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, most of my questions have been answered, but on Rigetti, we're thinking of acquiring the entire parcel, which is a couple hundred acres, is it not? A couple questions come to mind. What are we going to do with all that land, the city, and does it require annexation?
I can't answer the first question too well. What are we going to do with all the land? Does it require annexation? Technically not, but it is going to be, it'd be better to annex. I think that was a question we explored in the past, that annexation was advantageous to the city. Probably a little easier to annex than Rancho Colina, though we've had discussions with LAFCO staff. They'd be open to making it work either place. So.
Just before you go beyond Rigetti, refresh my memory. How many acres is that?
250 acres.
Oh, so it's a big footprint.
Yeah, it goes.
And it is in the county, but it's contiguous to Morro Bay City boundary.
Correct. The uppermost part of Rigetti is where the Nutmeg tank is, so it goes all the way from the highway up to the top of the hill there. So that'll give you kind of, if you can picture that in your head, that's the size of the property. Yeah. And goes from the city limits to the Rancho Colina Mobile Home Park.
My only other comment is that water reclamation is very high on my list for this overall project, and as a fatal flaw analysis, maybe we'll hear a little bit more from Fugro as we get their report. But it worries me that Moro Valley, with all its clay, is going to limit significantly our groundwater recharge capability, Boy, that's pretty close to a fatal flaw in my simple mind. So I go back to Chorro Valley, and I know that it's alluvial, and I know that if you have minimum water going down the hill there, that you have access to those wells as well. So I'm very interested to hear what Fugro has to say about our ability to help our Moro wells.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because actually two questions that I had on the report, this is on page 6. It says that the only portion of the Moro Valley that appears to have any feasibility for the development of surface infiltration and recharge ponds is just above the Narrows. And I was wondering, well, how large is this area? And is this area within Rigetti or the McElveen property? And I'm not even sure I know what the Narrows are. What does that mean?
We're addressing that in the next item, right?
Yep, that's okay. Correct. That's for the Fugard report. Paul Sorensen will get up and present on that, and he'll be able to respond to all your questions on that.
Okay.
Were those your questions related to this item, though?
Yeah, I was just following up with what you said. I'm concerned about the possibility to, because of the soil there.
Well, we'll discuss that in the next item. Okay. Barbara, did you have any comments or questions? Richard?
When, from my perspective, we were focusing on Rancho Colina completely since that, you know, the previous meeting. And the Rigetti site, when that was being considered, if memory serves, there were several citizens who threatened to sue if you put up a power, wastewater or water reclamation facility there. And that was a few years ago. And that was one of the negatives that occurred, or negatives toward that Rigetti site. And I kind of want to follow up what Dale was saying about the corporate yard. Is, you know, that kind of morphed into that project. Is that one of the reasons why Cayucas dropped out? Because we were morphing, our project started getting bigger?
And I'll try to speak to that. The way the corporate's been viewed, and I'll ask Rob to jump in and correct me if I misstate something, but the corporation yard, we don't see that. That's really not a wharf facility, right, Rob? That's a public works department facility.
Correct. So it's not in any of the wharf project costs. And one of the council goals from the very beginning was to site other city facilities along with the wharf project. So as Mr. Rickenbach said earlier, it's always been on our radar to include other city facilities because it makes sense to co-locate, because we're a small public works department. All of our guys work together.
Okay, so like basically what you're saying is the city council gave you direction to look at Rigetti and Rancho Colina all the time anyway.
Yes, look at the Moro Valley sites.
From the very
yes.
beginning. And then now they have a MOU to purchase the property as well, yeah?
Correct.
Okay. The other question was, my memory doesn't serve me that well, but there was an issue with annexation, and my understanding now is that Rigetti property is within the city limits, correct?
That's not correct. It's adjacent to the city.
Okay. There was an ordinance, I think it was number 167?
197.
What is it?
197.
197, that it would take a 218 vote to get a purchase property. Can you explain ordinance?
I can't explain it offhand because I'd have to remember it. But I know that you had brought that up before relative to a Prop 218 vote and annexation. I don't want to say something wrong. I'll look into that a little bit more. But again, I've had discussions with LAFCO on what it would take to actually annex, and it seems potentially relatively straightforward, but we'll look into that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, because LAFCO's LAFCO, but we are a city, so it's different.
So that citizens initiative required a vote of the people if an annexation was not to be used for municipal purposes.
Right.
So the water reclamation facility is a municipal purpose, so it is my understanding that it would not require a vote of the people to perform that annexation.
Right, but then it was kind of tied together with one of the reasons why Rancho Colina, because we were going to be able to supply them with water, right? To supply the trailer park, the Rancho Colina trailer park with water from the reclamation facility.
So it became a little bit more involved, correct?
Chances are that probably it would have to be served through an outside service agreement, not annexed into the city. We did not go fully down the road with finishing out all the requirements for that. We just weren't there yet. So,
okay, that's it.
Okay, any public comment on item B3? Please state your name, and you have 3 minutes, sir.
Good afternoon, Bill Martini, Morro Bay. Yeah, as far as the site locations, I know originally there were 17 sites, I believe, that were being studied. And at the time, I believe, also the Toro Creek area was talked about, but it was not on the market. It currently is on the market for sale, and that's one of Cayucas' preferred sites. They'll be making their decision on their sites on the 18th on what site they're going to pick. They're looking at Cayucas Creek, Toro Creek, and Old Creek. So, I mean, to put Rigetti and if the McElvain property is or not on the radar, that's another site that may be available as far as repartnering up with Cayucas. It's actually quite a good site. It may not be the perfect site, but it's quite a good site. Just to put that on everyone's radar. Secondly, the Tri-W site that's 150 acres inside the city limits was never studied, never on the radar. If you look at the original maps, what they were calling the Tri-W site was over by the Seashell community. It was like 17 acres. The actual property, they missed it. It's actually in the city limits. It has access from three directions. It's where the roundabout is. You go into it. It drains both into the Morro and the Chorro Valley, and it's not even in the county. It's in the city limits. That's been on the market for a while. It's also for sale. All the utilities butt up against it. It's rolling property. It's not 5 acres and then mountain goat property, just to let you know that there's other options out there if you're looking at other options right now as opposed to the Rigetti. Rigetti's not a bad site, but there's also other sites that weren't there that are there now, just to kind of let you know. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, this is also receive updates and just provide comments, which we think we've done. And I want to thank you, staff. One thing I've always asked is that we remain flexible in this analysis, and because you never know what fatal flaws are going to pop up. And, you know, here's a great example of us demonstrating that flexibility as we work through site analysis and final site selection. So good job. Look forward to the next steps in that full report. I guess I'm still talking. We're on to B4, the last item of our business section here. This is Morro Valley Groundwater Reconnaissance Study. So staff, take it away.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm going to turn it over to Paul Sorensen with Fugro. Paul is the principal hydrologist for this analysis. We've included a copy of the study in your staff report. Paul's going to walk us through it, also some of the major findings from his work.
And not to slight Paul, but I think he'd be referred to as a hydrogeologist instead of a hydrologist.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Rob. I sort of gave up worrying about that a long time ago. Good afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity to come. Again, yeah, as introduced, my name is Paul Sorensen. I'm a principal. I'm a hydrogeologist with Fugro Consultants. Our office is here in the county. We are in the city of San Luis for 25 years, and just recently moved up to Atascadero. is it this side button here? Yes, it is. What I'm going to talk about today is as we discussed, or as has been discussed today, this Moro Valley Reconnaissance Study, as we're characterizing it or as we're entitling it. It really was a feasibility level, kind of a screening investigation of the Moro Valley, and it wasn't a hard and fast limit of the upper reach of the valley, the end of the study area, but it was more of a, we decided among discussions here with staff and Mike and John that the upper end of the study area would be, you know, somewhere upstream of the McIlvaine property and or the Rancho Colina, and then all the way down and basically to Highway 1 and the Narrows, which I will get to, I'll point out on a map here. The objectives of the study, what I'll go through today, will I'll start out obviously with the objectives of the study, and then I want to spend just a minute on the data compilation side, which really is more almost more housekeeping and informational. But we'll get into that as I get to that part of the presentation. We'll go through that fairly quickly, but it's somewhat important. I'll describe very briefly the geologic setting, and then we'll get into the discussion of the geology and hydrogeology through this preparation of a whole series of cross sections, which if you've looked at your report, you'll that's kind of the focus of a lot of the study and aided us in developing this our conclusions of this feasibility level screening investigation. And then we'll get into the summary of the findings and our opinion of the conditions and then touch base at the end on some of the things that may be done to follow up on this event, depending on where we head next with the overall project and the concepts that are developed as part of the full team. Study objectives. We started out, as I said, with this, our charge being this to assess at a feasibility level screening investigation of the valley for purposes of evaluating the feasibility of developing a effluent disposal / groundwater recharge facility. Disposing effectively disposing of the effluent for purposes of enhancing the city water supply. So that really is a different focus than a lot of these types of studies that we've done a number of these for different communities over the years, but the, as I say, the little bit different twist to this, and I appreciate this from a groundwater supply side, which is where I spend most of my professional time, is that the purpose of this is to enhance the city water supply, and so it's an important distinction. We through these efforts, we compiled this comprehensive well log database. I'll get into that and discuss that. We prepared these cross sections and then looked at the subsurface conditions in the context of what we're trying to accomplish with the study. The focus of the data compilation task really came down to we made a request to California Department of Water Resources for a data dump of their well logs, the well completion reports of all the wells and borings that have been drilled in the valley. As of 1976, any boring or any water well that is drilled in the state now is required to, the drilling contractor is required to file a a well completion report, they call them, or a well log. And so up until July of last year, those logs were confidential. The law was finally passed in the state that makes those logs, or most of those information on those logs, public. And so we made a request of DWR for the well logs, and I'll show you the results of that request. We'll get in. We looked at USGS reports, previous consultant reports, and that formed, you know, that work formed the basis of our investigation. The extent of the DWR well log request is shown here. You know, here's the valley, Highway 1, of course. The Narrows is, and I'll have another map that will show this as well, but the Narrows is right here where the valley really pinches down as Morrow Creek and Little Morrow Creek converge and then flow through what it's just colloquially called the Narrows. So this area here is the extent of our data request from DWR. We received. I'll back up because the confidentiality of well logs was open to the public or was reduced in July. DWR was suddenly flooded with this very large request from people all over the state, of course, that were looking for well logs. And so what is normally a week or two process, 2 or 3 weeks at the most process to ask for a database of this extent, of which we've done many, many, many of these over the years. You know, now took 8 to 9 weeks, and just because they were so backed up. So that's partly why, or that's the main reason why we're here now rather than even a couple of months ago. We received somewhere over 500 pages of well logs from DWR. A lot of the information was duplicates or permits. A lot of the information or a lot of the logs could not be specifically identified as to location. And so this map shows locations of the logs in the upper in the valley that for which we had good identifiable locations as well as usable information on the logs. Some of the logs were just simply we drilled a well here. And the information was not useful. What we're looking for, of course, especially for a study such as this, is information directly related to well depth or the depth of the boring specifically, and hopefully as detailed a lithologic description as possible. That is, what materials did they encounter at what depths? And so that really helps us. The more detail that they can, that the driller puts into these logs, then the better it helps us. The more it helps us in these kinds of studies. For the area west of Highway 1, there's quite a collection of well logs. And again, because these are not all water wells, it's any boring or any monitoring well or a well log of any sort that is drilled. The drilling contractor, as I say, is required to submit the log to the state. And so, west of Highway 1, there's quite a large number of wells. Borings and CPT, these cone penetration test logs from previous investigations and other studies in our library at these locations, and then previous consulting work back several a couple of decades ago by Brown and Caldwell. They drilled a series of logs here in the or a series of wells borings in the central part of the valley here. So you put all these various data sets together, and we come up with here's locations of the well logs that went into this study. Again, Morrow Creek. Here's and Highway 1 or 41 coming down alongside Morrow Creek, Little Morrow Creek here. Coming down to the Narrows, and then of course Highway 1 here. So, and here's the general proximity of the McIlvain property, general proximity of the Rigetti property. So all of these reference the extent really of the study area. Real briefly on the geologic setting of the area. Again, the same reference. Here in yellow is the geologic extent or the extent of the river alluvium or the creek alluvium, the recent age, quaternary age, river gravels and alluvium laid down by Morrow Creek and Little Morrow Creek. The bedrock areas here in mostly greenish and purplish type of hues are all variations of one degree or another of what's called this Franciscan formation, which is a very thick, deep, what we call a fat clay in many respects. It's basically non-water producing. And so the focus of all of our studies are within the yellow here, the alluvial section of the valley. There's a lot of detail in these cross sections. You have them in 11x17, hopefully format in your report. So they're a little easier to view, but I'll run through them here now to give you an overall flavor and sense of the geologic and hydrogeologic setting of the valley. Colors are a little bit washed out here, so I'll point to some of these lines in separately. This is a cross section, or in other words, a profile looking basically down Morrow Creek. It extends from this point up valley all the way down alongside Morrow Creek down across Highway 1 and into the area west of the highway. What this shows, and this is entirely based on the our inspection of and interpretation of the lithology that is given in these well logs that was part of our database search, these vertical stick figures here along the on the profiles are all represent a boring and the geology and the lithology that's described within those borings. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of detail in those. I won't get into each one of the borings, but in very rough terms, the yellow within these borings represents a sand or very coarse grained material. The reddish colors in the borings and in these profiles all represent a very fine grained or clay rich.
Paul, yes. Can I interrupt you for a second?
Please.
I don't think it's showing, on mine, it shows brown below, it's showing basically bedrock, and on yours, it looks like it's all yellow going all the way down. Is it my eyes, or?
No, it's not your eyes.
So the line that I see, the dark line running across down below where the wells are drilled, that's the bedrock line, basically.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, that's why I say it's a little washed out.
Yeah, it was a little confusing for people, you know, at home trying to see this. If they see that, it looks like everything's yellow all the way down.
Yeah, so. That's exactly right, and I'm glad you pointed that out. Okay. On your graphics and in the report, all of this area is a much darker color. It's a brownish color, and that represents the bedrock. And so the base of the alluvial sediments in this profile, again, from here all the way down the creek, is this line. So I wonder if there's a, do you know if there's a pointer on this? Oh, that's better than mine. Okay. So this is the base of the alluvium, and everything below that is bedrock. Thank you for pointing that out.
So the people can see it at home, I'll just move the mouse cursor along there.
Okay.
Because that doesn't show up. The mouse reappears
on the bottom.
So you're tracing the base of the river or the creek alluvial sediments. Whoops. Well, the contact between the alluvial sediments and then underneath it is the bedrock. Yeah. So what we're looking at here on this cross section again, where the yellow above that contact line represent sands and a coarser grained material. The reds represent fine-grained clay-rich materials. When we're talking about infiltration and percolation of materials or of fluids and trying to either dispose of the effluent or recharge the groundwater basin, the coarser the materials, the better infiltration and percolation capacity. And so really what we're looking for is a thick section of sands and gravels or coarse grain materials. We want those materials to be laterally extensive and if we're trying to put new water into the section, then they have to be dry too. They have to be, you know, there has to be what we call available storage. If it's already saturated, we can't put more water into it. So what are we looking at here on this cross section down Morrow Creek? What we're seeing is that except for a very, very, very thin soil mantle right across the very surface of the ground, for the most part, the upper section of the valley, on that side of the valley at least, contains a pretty thick 20 to 30 to 40 foot thick section of fine grained materials, very clay rich materials. At the bottom of virtually all of the borings, We tend to see the sands and gravels and more sandy permeable materials. The only place that we see significant place where we see some of the creek sandy materials throughout the entire section or up to the surface is right where this profile, anyway, crosses Morrow Creek. And so we see here in Morrow Creek the creek itself, I mean the creek, that you know, kind of the defined bed and bank, so to speak, of the creek itself is for the most part coarse grains, sandy materials. And the rest of the valley, at least along that profile, is fine-grained. Let's look at this long profile that basically runs down Little Morrow Creek. So here, highlighted here, is this the extent of this section here along Little Morrow Creek. And again, each one of these vertical profiles represents a boring log, and our interpretation of the boring system or the lithologic system, the hydrologic regime. Again, this right here is this line of the contact between the alluvial materials above and bedrock below. And we see a very similar pattern as what we saw down Morro Creek. That is, for the most part, the valley is comprised of fine-grained clay-rich materials, except right in the creek, the kind of the bed and bank area of the creek itself. So we're everywhere where the profile line of profile crosses the creek, we actually get some sandy materials that come to the surface. You know, for instance, down here, and then down at the very bottom, right before Highway 1.
Can I ask one more question on this one? From about the 0.4,000 feet on the thing towards the ocean, that's all pretty open as an aquifer, is it not? Yeah, or is it broken? Do you follow what I'm saying? It looks to me like you do have sand and gravel from the ocean back to about 4,000 feet. Yeah, right about there.
Yes, possibly. And I'm going to get to that if I can get to that.
Okay,
and if I don't answer your question when I get there, then please bring it up again.
Sure.
So now let's go look at some profiles across the valley. So this one, CC prime, is up at the top end of the valley, basically from the area of the McIlvain property across to the other side of a little Morro Creek. And these sections, I know from that distance, are a little small. They're a little easier to look at in the report itself. But again, we see a similar pattern where we have this thin veneer of sandy material right at the surface that is pretty shallow, and then it goes into these pretty ubiquitous clay-rich, fine-grained materials that extend clear across the valley. The only place where we have fairly thick sections of sandy permeable sediments are right in the creek systems themselves, over here in Morro Creek and over here in Little Morro Creek. And it appears that everything in between is for the most part a fine-grained material. This DD prime is down here just upstream of the narrows. You know, these maps here show, just because of the shaded relief, shows how the narrows really look. The narrows here is this area right where Little Morro and Morro converge, and we have this ridge of bedrock that extends out almost to the creek. And it forms a very, very narrow spot right here where the creek flows through this bedrock high that is seen on both sides of the valley. So that's what we're talking about with the narrows. Okay, back to the profile. Again, here's the contact between the overlying creek alluvial materials and the underlying bedrock. It shows that we have, for the most part, a fine-grained, clay-rich material throughout the valley. What we're seeing here, and we actually saw it on the long profiles down the creeks, is kind of this two-aquifer system where we have a relatively thick clay zone with a intermediate sandy permeable zone, followed by a clay-rich zone, and then at the very bottom of the alluvium is another permeable sandy zone. And I'll get to that in the next profile. I'll describe that a little bit more. Once again,
we have a question on this before.
Excuse
you go
me.
Ahead.
I'm sorry, back to the narrows.
Uh-huh.
So can you point out where the Rigetti property ends? Is it in the narrows, or is it next to the narrows? Where's the narrows with Rigetti?
This is, the, in general, the area of the Rigetti property. And what I'm talking about with the narrows is this point right down here. Highway 41 goes right along that side of the valley, and then it flows. You go through the narrows right at this point.
So you were mentioning in your report then, I guess my question that I asked too soon was that would be the only area where you thought that you could get some percolation, is that it? But that's not even on either one of the properties we're looking at.
Not directly on the property, no. And we'll get to that because that comes to this gentleman's question as well. When I come to the description of the our findings and the hydrogeologic conditions, we can talk about that more. But you're right. The opportunity, and we'll jump ahead. We'll jump ahead to the conclusions in that sense.
Thank you.
There is. Well, I was going to say little to no. There is no opportunity for recharge or effluent disposal on those properties themselves. They entirely are underlain entirely by this Franciscan formation, which is this very clay-rich, virtually impermeable, non-water-bearing materials that forms those hillsides out there that are the host of landslides and there, you know, there's they are considered non-water bearing, and just as they're considered non-water bearing for the purposes of extracting water, it also means you can't put water into it either. It's just going to run off. So neither of the sites are suitable for the development of those kind of facilities.
And one thing I'd like to elaborate on, too, on that point, it's rare that you would find a good treatment plant site where you'd also be able to get to recharge all the water you generate. So it's common to have these facilities for recharge, whether they're percolation or injection wells, that sort of thing, at a different location. So it doesn't mean that that's still not a good site for a reclamation facility, like a treatment facility. May just not be where you apply the water.
Well, and additionally, I think one of the primary tasks from the Coastal Commission was to move the facility out of the coastal hazard zone and the flood zone, which if you look at the basin itself, that's primarily where the recharge areas are flood zones.
Yep.
So we have to build a facility out of the flood zone, but next to the best recharge area possible. So it'd be impossible anyway from a permitting standpoint to put it over a recharge area.
Good point.
That's a good point.
I think basically what they're saying is that recharge is feasible primarily from the narrows west, not within the valley.
Right.
As you go up.
Yeah, I got that.
So,
okay.
But what does that mean? How much horizontal distance in an alluvial, loose alluvial, do you need to change effluent to potable water or something that's usable? All these questions are still hanging, and I don't hear any answers.
Well, we will get to the discussion of a couple of those things right now, but we don't have a lot of those answers because that's some of those questions are really they'll come in the next step when the concepts are more fully developed of where we're going to put these things. Right now, we were looking at the valley itself. Is it even feasible to put in a system where we can recharge the basin and dispose of the effluent? And what we're seeing here, as I described, this is a profile here in the middle of the valley. We have a lot of data here. We see this two aquifer system sitting on top of the bedrock, but an awful lot of clay and fine-grained materials. So let's go to some of these findings. Like I've been describing here, the alluvium consists of these interbedded coarse and fine-grained materials throughout the valley. The thickness is variable. It ranges anywhere from 30 to 40 feet on the one side of the valley to as much as 80 to 85 feet down just upstream of the narrows. So that's the thickest part of the section as far as alluvium. The near-surface materials, like I've described in these profiles, is predominantly fine-grained. What I've alluded to throughout this presentation is that fine-grained materials are not good for purposes of developing a a disposal system or a percolation recharge pond system surface infiltration of this effluent. So what we're getting at is that for the most part, the valley is not a very feasible site for developing a relatively large scale percolation pond or infiltration type of system for purposes of groundwater recharge. The coarse grain materials that we see near the surface throughout the valley, except right in the creeks themselves, the bed and banks of the creeks, are very limited both laterally and vertically.
And Paul, we'll have a real quick question.
Yeah.
Would you characterize the Moro Valley as a percolating groundwater basin or a stream flowing through known and defined channels?
You're asking me a legal question, which I'd be glad to opine on, but I'm not a water rights attorney. But this is a classic example of a alluvial aquifer within defined bed and banks, and all of the groundwater within that system is considered underflow from a legal standpoint as opposed to a percolating groundwater basin material.
And Paul, that's supported by the fact that the State Board has regulatory authority over this basin, and the city has a appropriative right to use that water. One of the few groundwater situations where the state does take regulatory authority in California.
Well, yeah, up until Sigma, I guess the only place that the state had regulatory authority was in the riparian or the underflow water, which in this case is the entire aquifer, because it's bounded by virtually non-water bearing bedrock.
Paul, would it be fair to say that the bedrock, as you show the cross-section, it goes downgrade towards the ocean, and so any percolation down to bedrock would flow rather than pool, like maybe the San Joaquin Valley or other places where you can pool water underground, it would flow like an underground river would towards the ocean above the bedrock? Is that a fair statement?
In very general terms, very simplistic terms, yes. You know, we didn't look at water levels in detail in the valley, but the overall gradient of any groundwater in that alluvial system is going to be downstream. So it's going to flow from the upper part of the valley down to the narrows, through the narrows, and beyond. It won't pool
up. What I'm trying to get at is that you say you insert effluent at McIlvain's elevation, and rather than pooling water into an underground lake, it would be an underground stream, if you will, that would go downhill towards the high school. Is that correct?
It will flow down the valley. It's and forgive me, I don't want to get into a semantics thing, but it's not an actual underground river, because it still flows through the pores and the interstices, the pores of the materials of those unconsolidated alluvium, but it does flow. You're characterizing it correctly, that it will flow from that elevated part of the valley, down valley towards the high school, through the narrows, and out to the ocean. So, what is our opinion, or what are our conclusions here? Well, the valley profile, it's interbedded. We've talked about that. It's dominated by fine grain materials. We've talked about that. Those conditions impede or retard or make it relatively infeasible. It makes it infeasible for developing a large scale percolation groundwater recharge facility or effluent disposal facility throughout most of the valley. The only place that it may be feasible from looking at the database that we have at this point is this area just upstream of the Narrows, where you all picked out from the cross sections. There's an awful lot of yellow in those cross sections at the mouth of the valley, just upstream of the Narrows, where the Little Morrow and Morrow Creeks come together. We've obviously had a history, geologic history of those streams, and different points of convergence of those two streams, where we have it appears to be more coarse-grained materials. So, to get back to your question, if we can develop some surface infiltration or percolation pond facility in that area just upstream of the Narrows, how long will that take for the water to get to the city's well fields or well field? That's a key question, because there are regulatory constraints on what they call residence time and it depends on the level of treatment, it depends on the materials, it depends on how you even analyze your residence time between putting it in the ground and extracting it through a water well downstream. But those can be analyzed, and we can figure that out. My sense is, and that's always dangerous, especially my sense, my sense is that a percolation pond facility somewhere upstream of that confluence would give us enough residence time before the city's production wells. Now, we also have to worry about any other private wells in that zone, though. So there's some more analysis that has to be done for that concept if we go that way, and that comes to this follow-on work efforts section that I've listed a number of things here that we could do. You know, if we want to evaluate that lower part of the valley just upstream of the Narrows, we need to do some borings on some of the private property there or some easements. We need to do some laboratory testing of the permeability and the grain sizes of those of materials. We need to pump some water wells to get some aquifer characteristics and parameters, and probably do some field site testing as well with infiltration tests and so on. If that's the direction we want to go, because there are other concepts that we're going to have to discuss as a royal we team, to look at other concepts such as putting that water into a seawater intrusion barrier concept system downstream of the city's wells in order to prevent any seawater intrusion, which allows us to pump more water out of the city's wells. I know that's a concept. There's others, in lieu disposal or in lieu use of that effluent to some of the ag users, direct discharge. There's a number of components of these things that we need to kind of discuss as concepts before we jump into some of these field related and relatively expensive analytical processes first. And so anyway, that summarizes, I guess I had till 4:45 and so I'm late, and so that summarizes my
I have a quick question if I could. But prior to even getting into these further studies, if you throw 1 million gallons a day at the Narrows, is it going to be bubbling out of the ground before it ever makes its way down to the ocean?
Well, and that's a...
That would be my question of, do we need to think about maybe half this flow needs to go to some other kind of use other than trying to percolate? Do you follow where I'm trying to go with this?
Absolutely. And we've had these discussions, and Mike, just jump in, if you want to, get to it rather than me. But there certainly is a seasonality to all of this. With this type of system, you know, and the hydrologic regime that we have here in Moro Valley, and the same thing is going to be true in Choro as well. When we in wintertime, and you know, assuming that it rains in winter, the stream systems, they fill up and water levels come up, and we no longer have available storage. I referred to earlier. And once an aquifer system fills up and there's no more available storage, we can't put any more effluent in there. So there's this seasonality issue that we have to deal with. So what are we going to do in those wet weather times? Do we dispose of it offshore? Do we build a seawater intrusion barrier so we can pump our city wells more? There's not one answer to any of this. So it's going to have to be a combination of these different types of concepts.
Yeah, Paul, I'll add to that, too. What we're finding with most of the agencies and most of the situations we're dealing with is there's no one way that agencies are using to reuse their water. It's a combination of things. Could be direct delivery to some users. It could be one of the modes of reuse. So it could be three or four different solutions, three or four different locations. But the goal is to come up with the most cost effective and the most valuable way to do that from your perspective and council's perspective. The highest and best use of the water kind of becomes part of that discussion too.
Well, I would ask the city, are they going to entertain any of these follow-up efforts, and how serious is the city thinking about them, and what is the timing? I'd hate to see the city commit to a site that limits its ability to utilize effluent most effectively or most efficiently. So, this is a timely issue. And I would be interested to hear what the city's plans are.
Sure, and I'll tackle that one. So the thing that we've recognized and kind of brought back to the committee and also council several times is we recognize that the ultimate reuse opportunities for the water take a little longer for fleshing out because there are legal constraints, institutional constraints. You need groundwater study. You really need to think it through before you've kind of dived into the construction. And that's why this our goal is to move as quickly as possible on identifying the ultimate reuse opportunities and helping the city put a program together. But these questions take some time. Part of the next thing we're going to do with Paul is sit down and prioritize these and identify the next steps and start moving forward with them. So that's the plan. Is we're not stopping or taking a break or anything like that. We're going to keep moving.
Can I ask one thing though, Mike? I don't see the siting coming into play as how we get rid of this water. I think the siting is the siting to run a plant, and then you're going to carry that water somewhere else, whether it be to the Narrows or through some kind of... Am I wrong in that assumption?
No, you're not. That's correct. So when the city narrowed the locations to the Moro Valley sites, the thoughts were those are the ones that are relatively close to the city's current collection system, so kind of require the least modifications to collection system. They're close to the city's groundwater supplies in Moro Valley. They're close to direct reuse opportunities up Moro Valley. And so those points are still valid, and either one of those two sites would work for it. And I think the chairman's comment on one of the issues with siting a wastewater plant, and one of the reasons a lot of folks have problems with their wastewater plants, is because, those were they're placed in the floodplain 30 years ago or 40 plus years ago. A lot of times those were the best areas for perk too. That's one of the reasons, or percolation. That's one of the reasons plants were placed there. So with the siting, you siting a treatment plant is very often kind of has a different set of questions than where you're going to place your reuse opportunities specifically.
Excellent. Any other comments? We're coming up on time, so
okay.
We'll cautious with that, please.
You mentioned percolating facility. I'm not thinking that way, but I'm thinking for reuse. there's have you studied some of the Cleath work on this? Cleath and Associates?
Yes.
Okay. When they, so we have some information on how long it takes for the movement of water from the Moro Valley through the Narrows. Is that right? Now, currently, when you're thinking as far as the feasibility of reuse, are you thinking that enough detention time or enough time goes by that the water is filtered for immediate reuse? Or is it when you go to the Narrows? Or are you thinking that that water still is going to need further treatment?
You know, when we look at what I referred to earlier as residence time, that's the amount of time that that is required for the groundwater to, or this disposed of water to flow through the ground such that when it's pulled out of a well, it can be used directly.
Okay. Here's a little where when it comes to the Narrows, what we have right now is we have our city wells that we have near the Narrows that we pump out. Now, upstream, okay, this is where I disagree with staff. Staff says that we have basically sewage identified in the Moro Basin Narrows downstream. Moro Bay staff says it's coming from state water. I've followed up with a report about 7 years ago and saying that it's from a dilapidated infrastructure of sewage infrastructure that is, there's a boundary layer right there where you say the Narrows is, specifically 1840 Main, where the MTB remediation occurred and took out some of the boundary layer on that Narrows. And I'm saying that there's sewage entering through there. So currently, we are running our water through the desal plant and blending it as a blend, getting the MCLs down so we could deliver. I look at this particular exercise as not, I don't see it as a problem to be able to do that, and especially to address saltwater intrusion like you talk about, and also having other options as reuse. And I agree with Steven on the fact that with regards to a location, you know, that's a kind of a separate issue. These reuse issues are separate. But I feel that it's not necessarily just because we're not looking at a percolation pond. We're looking at someplace to discharge and eventually be able to use it. And our city wells are right there already. And I assume that most of your good data came from like the 60 some odd wells that they drilled, right, for the MTBE monitoring wells, that some of that data is better than the upstream data. Is that right? As far as your boring identification data?
Yeah, those logs are generally better because they were logged by a geologist or an engineer, and so they're more detailed. Yeah. No, most of those are downstream of Highway 1, and so
right.
You know, we were right at Highway 1, and so that wasn't really helpful for a lot of the feasibility screening that we were doing up valley. But yeah, those logs are better. And I often referred to the concepts that we're talking about as percolation ponds or surface infiltration, and that's not to rule out. And I'm glad you brought that up. The possibility of developing a direct discharge facility, you know, to right into the stream. We clearly have to study what that means. We don't want to develop a new riparian habitat that will force us to keep that water going all the time for perpetuity. But you know, that's another concept that I need to. I didn't mean to rule it out when I was saying percolation pond and surface infiltration, but
okay.
Glad you brought that up.
Are we able to wrap it up, you think, before 5, or do we need a motion? Are we looking good? Okay. Thank you, Paul, for your presentation.
You.
Appreciate it. Any public comment on this item?
Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll need a motion then to go past 5.
Make a motion to go past 5.
Okay, we'll give us at least 15 minutes here.
Second.
Okay. Motion by Woodson, second by Barbara. Okay.
Yeah, Bill Martini again. Just a real quick comment. And that is, I noticed your study didn't go any further up Highway 41 than McIlvain's property. And yet, there's 600 acres of avocados upstream that are pulling water out of the upper aquifer. And if that was taken into consideration, number one, if you ran the water all the way upstream and recharged higher upstream, there'd be double the size of the aquifer to recharge as it does work its way down. The aquifer itself is like underground lakes. It doesn't totally flow without any retention. There's built-in ponds underneath there, so you have one pond to the next and the next underground. So you would have a chance to replenish all those aquifers if you just ran the water further upstream, and it's very cheap to pump water. That's not a big deal. The second thing is off-site retention. As far as a storage pond, it's like the Sierras store the snow in the wintertime. That's exactly kind of the concept as far as grabbing your water, putting it into an off-site, ponding area or lake or that, and then you just release it in the spring or in the summer as you need it. As the aquifer draws down, then it just recharges. So that's kind of the balance between the two. And getting back to the Churro Valley, talking about the Tri-W property, you'll notice there's a big box canyon right by the seashell community. Not suggesting that, but that's one where you could just box it and it would hold probably 1,000 to 1,500 acre feet. And then you just let it dribble out into the Churro or into the Morro. So those are a couple concepts for holding water in the wintertime and letting it recharge in the summer like your snowmelt. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? All right, we'll close item B4, receive the
study. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I just need to clarify what Mr. Sagowski characterized as staff's opinion on the...
Okay, please go ahead.
Just that our opinion, and supported by regional board staff, is the nitrate contamination in the Morro Valley is mainly coming from agricultural runoff. There, we did a sucralose and caffeine study that showed there is sucralose and caffeine in the Morro Valley. Working with regional board staff, we tied that to irrigation return water for those concentrations. But we're not of the opinion that the nitrate contamination in the Morro Valley is primarily due to sewage. It's primarily due to agricultural runoff.
Okay, thank you for those clarifications.
I need to respond to that. First of all,
I'll give you a couple minutes.
Okay, a couple minutes. First of all, there was no sucralose that was found in the Morro Valley. It was found downstream of the sewer lines. And secondly, the nitrate contaminations that occurred in the test that we did, that you did, and also it was stated in 2007 the city had, in a letter to the regional board, ruled out any sewage as contributing to nitrate contamination. And your boss has that letter. And then later on, the city had changed their position about 7 years later. So it to be clear, what I was saying is that we have I'm not saying all of the nitrates, but I'm saying it's contributing to the nitrates in the Morro Basin.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
I stand by my comments.
That's Mr. fine. Chair. You're both concise, and I appreciate it. That's what I appreciate. Okay, we're moving on to closing comments. We have any closing comments on today from members? Dale, are you wanting to?
Yeah, just thank you very much. Good report. I really enjoyed it.
Do you have any plans for doing any further testing up the valley? This gentleman suggested that we have sources further up the valley that we haven't even looked at.
The direction, the way we see it, the direction from council has really been focused more on enhancing city water supply. That's been one of the directives. We want to focus more on the lower end of the valley because we know the hydraulic connectivity, direct connectivity is there. We're not going to rule anything out, but I would say the focus right now for our efforts would be the lower part of the valley.
And I see that part of the menu of reuse options.
That's correct.
If the beneficiaries upstream are willing to fund infrastructure and pay for their benefits received, then that's an option available.
Part of what we're going to do, too, is part of the master reclamation plan that will be funded 50% through that state water board grant, is we're going to look at a variety of different recycled water opportunities, including direct delivery to folks up the valley. So I don't want to make it sound like we're not going to explore. We are planning to explore that. That's definitely one of the items in the menu.
Okay. Down here.
Mike, what'd you say about 50%? It went over me, but it sounded important to me.
So the grant, that application that was submitted to State Water Resources Control Board for the recycled water feasibility study, that grant, that $75,000 would be applied towards the city's master reclamation plan.
Oh, okay.
So we can start that effort once we've heard that, you know, if the city gets awarded, then we can start that effort and the city can charge that for towards that grant.
Rob, I guess it's my turn. Is it my turn?
Sure.
Okay. Rob, I got a question.
These are closing comments.
I got a question. Couldn't you figure out where that sewage came from with DNA? I mean, the estuary did. What's the source, whether it's ag or human? I mean, that's pretty easy, isn't it?
We've done isotope testing. The conclusion of the regional board is to not expend any more effort in researching this.
Okay. Oh, and then the last thing for Rob is, is desal in this equation at all?
Of course it's in the equation, because really to make highest and best use for direct or indirect use of the water, we'll have to desal it either on the way up or on the way down.
Paul.
Possibly both.
Just real quick, I wanted to thank Paul also for the presentation. That was very educational. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to wrap this meeting up, adjourn it. We're coming back March 1st, 2016, here at 3 p.m., unless we have the joint meeting.
There is a joint meeting proposed, and Rob, I don't know if...
I think you're still being polled along with council as a possibility to change that meeting date.
Yes, exactly. But nonetheless, we will meet the first. I won't be
correct.
Canceled at the
That's correct.
Meeting. Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, presenters, today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.